Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 110 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Due to the efforts of Pat, we have two cases today, even though pickings continue to be limited. But the good news is unlike a week or so ago, we actually have a couple of cases today. The first case today...
I will say that counsel for the appellee in both of these cases wish we didn't, frankly. It was a rough day for the appellees.
I agree. We'll get into that.
Which is kind of a preview of the predictions sure to go wrong, but bad week for the appellees.
Oh my God. First case today is from the 4th District, and it's Fox versus Ameren in Illinois. The second case today is Meyer versus Hollister, Inc. We'll get into that as well. With that, let's turn to our first case. Does a state statute requiring power lines to be 21 feet above the ground trump the common law analysis of open and obvious for the determination of duty? Does it change the analysis that the power lines were 17 and a half feet above the ground? Does it matter that 30 days prior to the plaintiff's injury, there was another incident involving these same power lines? And a hypothetical from one of the justices, could the power company put the power lines at 4 feet and use open and obvious as a defense? These are among the questions to be addressed when the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District, decides Fox versus Ameren in Illinois. The plaintiff was injured when he extended a boom on his truck for work near power lines. He saw the power lines and had a spotter and did that work anyway. He was injured. The circuit court granted summary judgment to the defendant, and the plaintiff appealed, contending that the statute defined the duty, that the defendant had notice of the problem, and that in any event, the condition was not open and obvious, notwithstanding an Illinois Supreme Court precedent suggesting that power lines are always open and obvious. Pat, tell us about oral argument in this interesting case.
Thanks, Dan. And so you may be getting bored with all the open and obvious cases, but it is one of the principal defenses that landowners use and others to defeat negligence claims. And it's important, I say this, I think, every time we talk about this, it's important to keep in mind which element the open and obvious doctrine goes towards. And it goes towards the duty element. So it goes towards something that is a question of law. This is not an analysis of causation, which is usually a question of fact for the jury. This is only on the duty element, not the breach or causation element, and obviously not the damages element. So it's important to keep that in mind, is did the defendant have a duty in the first instance to do or not do the thing they are alleged to have done or not done? That's the issue. Okay. So the first thing to keep in mind, Dan mentioned there at the end, that there's an Illinois Supreme Court case that suggests that power lines are always open and obvious. Counsel, I don't know if it was counsel for the appellant, that it would be counsel for the injured person, or one of the justices that pointed out that case talks about, I think it was counsel for the appellant, said that case talks about the landowner, not the power company. And his argument is essentially that the power company, notice the defendant in this case is Ameren. For those that are up, those who are not familiar, Ameren is a large power supplier downstate, not so much up here around Chicago, where right. ComEd is the principal power supplier. But Ameren is the power supplier downstate, and the argument is that they owe a higher duty because here they have these high voltage lines all over the place, and they've got to do, they know what's there, and they need to protect people, and they need to follow the regulations and statutes that govern how these lines are protected and how high above the ground they are. And apparently there's a state statute that says they have to be 21 feet above the ground, and these were plainly not. They were 17 and a half. That is not disputed. So the question is, notwithstanding that breach of the statute, was there a duty by the power company to the plaintiff simply because of this failure to make sure the lines were at 17 and a half, or at 21 feet. And the court seemed to suggest that, hold it, the statute trumps the common law. The open and obvious doctrine is a common law defense to the duty element of a negligence cause of action, and that defines what the duty is. Something like when you have a car accident and someone is driving in excess of the speed, that the posted speed, that could be you breached the duty, or you made a left turn on red or a right turn on red in certain circumstances when you're not allowed to do that, that kind of a thing. Usually you're allowed to make right turns on red. Sometimes you're not. So you violated whatever the statute or regulation governing the traffic was. A similar idea that can be used as evidence of the duty to show that your breach of it, your breach. So you get those two elements if you're the plaintiff. The other thing that was interesting is the defendant relied on case law that's regarding whether a statute could foreclose defenses and said, well, no, it really couldn't. But that case, as one of the justices pointed out, dealt with the causation element, not the duty element. Essentially, the argument is that the General Assembly has set the public policy of the state regarding the height of these power lines. And in the absence or in the failure to comply with that obligation, there is there's a duty, and now we go figure out if there's a breach. Doesn't seem there was much of a dispute as to breach, and now we look at causation. And you could raise, counsel, and this is the justice speaking, you could raise all those defenses at trial, but as to contributory fault, and he ignored the open and obvious danger. You could argue that all on the you can argue all of that on the causation element at trial, but you can't say that there was no duty in the first instance. But that, which brings us back to the foreseeability element, which is one of the factors, one of the four factors you look at in the four-factor analysis for determination of duty. And it's really the touchstone, but it also shows up in the causation element. Foreseeability, was it foreseeable that someone would work under power lines? Well, there was this incident 30 days before at this very location where just such a thing happened and someone was apparently injured. And the claim was, at least I don't think this was disputed, that Ameren knew about it. So you have the same circumstance with the same condition and someone being injured at that location, and you guys didn't do anything to fix the situation, either prevent anyone from going out there or getting the power lines raised or doing something to prevent this from happening. This did not go well for the defendant of Appalee. They were not buying the argument. Not that there should be judgment entered against Ameren, just that summary judgment shouldn't have been entered in their favor, and the case needs to go back, it seemed, from the questioning of the court to the circuit court for further proceedings. Dan, anything else to add on this particular case?
No, I think you covered it, Pat. I think that... like you said, I don't think it went well for the defendant here, at least for the granting of the motion for summary judgment, and I think it'll go back. You know, the question, I guess, would be, you know, what someone like Ameren could do in these situations. I guess you would put up signs or something, right, or do something if that's the burden.
Or raise the power lines.
Yeah, I don't know how easy
there's
it is.
There's always that. Comply with the statute.
right. No, I agree. I just don't know what that entails. You know, I guess taller poles and, plant some taller poles or something.
Or tauten or make that, them
that's
taut.
True. Yeah.
That's an option. It may be that it's difficult to tauten these poles. Is that a word? I don't know. But I don't know if it's difficult to do that in this circumstance. I will say this is not work I want to do.
No.
I think when there are people that do that work, that seems like rather dangerous work. But
it does.
That's the kind of thing I would suspect that they'd have to do.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with this case. This is not the last we've heard of it.
Not for sure.
It's going back. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with another whistleblower case. what is it? What is with all these whistleblower cases recently? Well, I'll say this. I said at the beginning of the pandemic that there was going to be a lot of employment litigation. You know, people losing their jobs, and they're going to find a reason to start suing. Now, this, I don't think this happened during the pandemic. I think that happened before it. But the amount of employment, this is not the kind of increase in employment litigation I expected, but here it is. Lots of whistleblower litigation.
For sure.
So with that, we'll come back with segment two. We're back for segment two of episode 110 of the Podium and Panel podcast and discussing a whistleblower case. Can a plaintiff get past a motion to dismiss on a retaliatory discharge claim where the conduct for which he claims to have been fired for reporting did not violate any rule, regulation, or statute? Can the defendant prevail on a motion to dismiss under 735 ILCS 5/2-619A9, which permits the defendant to introduce affirmative matter that contradicts allegations of the complaint that the defendant contends but did not specifically identify as not well pled? You can't contradict well-pled allegations, but you can contradict conclusory allegations. And Dan's going to tell us about that part of the argument.
Yeah.
What does it mean for the plaintiff's supervisor, the general counsel, by the way, the plaintiff is a lawyer, to ask the plaintiff to, quote, hide or, quote, park $43,000 in company funds? Those are among the questions the Illinois Appellate Court First District will decide when it resolves Mayer versus Hollister, Inc., that was argued this past week. The amended verified complaint is a mere 412 paragraphs. The plaintiff, a lawyer working in the general counsel's office, received the following email from the general counsel. Quote, one additional thing. I, quote, upped, end quote, the IP law team's budget request. The amount of the request is redacted. And instead of requested, and again, the amount is redacted, as a means to, quote, hide, end quote, or park, end quote, the additional $43,000, because I have no doubt that other groups will need additional funds. Service business units for certain, end quote of the email. This is the email that started this thing.
That's right.
The plaintiff refused to participate and was ultimately fired. He filed claims under the Illinois Whistleblower Act, common law, retaliatory discharge, promissory estoppel, and fraudulent inducement. The defendant moved to dismiss, in which affidavits were offered that claimed to show that nothing that was done was improper. The circuit court agreed and dismissed the complaint. That's after at least one amendment to the complaint.
Right.
The plaintiff appealed. Under Section 619A9, a defendant admits the truth of the allegations and that they are sufficient to state a claim, but offers affirmative evidence that defeats or avoids the claim. Not true motions to dismiss of this kind are not permitted under Illinois law. Justice Hyman certainly believed the motion to dismiss filed in this case was such a motion. Dan, tell us about this long and just, it was a very rough ride for the counsel for the appellee.
Well, your statement at the end that Justice Hyman believed that the motion to dismiss was such a motion, was a not true motion, is a very brief summary of the very intense questioning of appellee's counsel. He wasn't buying anything. He kept coming back to 2619 versus 2615.
And 2615 is the like the Illinois equivalent of 12B6.
Right.
There isn't a federal analog of 619A9. That just doesn't exist.
No. It's unique to Illinois. The complaint, as you say, Pat, was 412 paragraphs. It was a verified complaint. It went into great elaborate detail on each of the elements and all the things. So like you said, here's the setup. The whistleblower in this case was the legal counsel for the intellectual property, the IP section, and he was responsible for putting together a budget. The budget went to his general counsel. The general counsel goes to the board, gets approval. The budget that's submitted to the overall board is an overall budget that doesn't have these pieces in it, comes back, and then the email that you read starts this chain. The IP lawyer says, look, this is a violation of the model rules of professional conduct, right? I'm doing unethical things. the argument of Appelli and of his of the general counsel who put this $43,000 parked and hid. Those were the exact words that you read were put into the thing, hide and park. And a lot of the questions from Justice Walker and especially from Justice Hyman had to do with what exactly do these words mean when you say hide. The trial court, as you mentioned, did in fact grant the motion, the 2619 motion. And again, a lot of Justice Hyman's questions had to do with the fact that, as you mentioned, what he was saying is that the defendant here, Hollister and its parent company, were making assertions and making arguments of fact and factual disputes with respect to the pleadings. The appellee said, no, that's not what we're doing. We're attacking it because there's no claim. As you mentioned, Pat, there's one of the disputes here or arguments of the appellee is that there's no violation here, that this is not an ethical violation, this money, that there's no crime, there's no statutory violation that can be cited to, there's no SEC violation, there's none of that can be pinpointed to. And the argument, as you mentioned, went, I think it was an hour and 5 minutes or something like that. The appellant, I think, got up for about 15 minutes, right? The normal time frame, reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. And then, as you mentioned, it was a little bit, uncomfortable listening to this questioning, because it really was really just came out of the box. And Justice Hyman from the start, he asked the question of the appellee, are you admitting that it's a good claim? And then whether there was questions of fact that were being raised in these affidavits. The affidavits, according to the advocate for the appellee, really tried to say, whether or not the whistleblower actually cooperated or participated in this. Again, all that was said was that $43,000 was put into the IP budget. The Hollister's position, and I think the trial court's view, was that these are just different pockets of Hollister, and Hollister can, the budget was approved by the board, so they can put the money in any pocket they want to. I think one of the things that Justice Hyman kept coming back to was whether any citation was not well pled, whether the allegations were not well pled, because that's what this 2619 is getting to. And the advocate for the appellee, again, kept responding, that she disagreed with the characterization of how their answer went. And like you said, Justice Hyman was just not buying what the advocate for appellee had to say about the pleadings being conclusory. As we talked about in the break, Pat, if you got something like this, a 412 paragraph verified complaint, that probably the first motion of the defendant in a case like this would be to make clear that you should not be required to provide a verified answer, because again, it gets into the issues of request to admit and the limitations in Illinois on those. Again, Justice Hyman was really honing in on, at one point, he said something about complaint that the defense was not saying it was not conclusory, that in some ways he flipped it onto the defendants, so that their statements that the pleadings were not well pled, that their answers were in fact not well pled, because they didn't say what was conclusory, what was problematic of the 420 paragraphs. And so like the first case, I think this one's coming back based on Walker and Hyman. Anything to add on that, Pat?
Yeah, I think that what Justice Hyman was looking for is you needed a list of the conclusory allegations that
right.
that the appellee thought were improper and not admitted, and that therefore they could challenge those. They could challenge those through the affidavits offered in support of the 619 motion to dismiss. I will say Illinois is a fact pleading state.
It is.
This is the most intensively fact pled complaint that I've ever seen. I'm sure there are others that were at least as, I can't imagine one being more intensively right. fact pled than this particular complaint. Dan also raised the issue of what if they ever have to answer this thing, which I think they're going to have to go back and answer.
I think so.
All pleadings in Illinois, once a pleading is verified, everything thereafter has to be verified unless you get an excuse for good cause shown. And let me tell you, I can't imagine trying to, it would take weeks to prepare. First of all, to get someone to be able to verify it on behalf of the company.
Right.
And second of all, to be able, I mean, one of the things is, how does he know all this stuff? I mean, it's verified by the plaintiff. He knows all of these things. His deposition is going to be a very rich experience.
Which is interesting because when it was on rebuttal, I think it was the advocate for the appellant talked about the fact that they don't have certain things. They don't have the policy, the whistleblower policy. They don't have certain things. And so raises an interesting question. How do you verify all these specific detailed facts when you admit that you don't have certain documents to be able to, you know, these are based on information and belief, I guess, some of them. So interesting issue.
Yeah, I it's going to be very, very interesting, the discovery in this case, and extraordinarily expensive to litigate this case. Over a $43,000 parked pot of money on a company that on this giant company. I can't imagine. I mean, it seems that there was an investigation by outside counsel that came in, found that the general counsel didn't do anything wrong, and that the lawyer didn't do anything wrong. You know, the plaintiff didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But okay, that's fine. But why would a lawyer ever put the words "hide and park" in an email?
Right.
I mean, I don't know why he would put such a thing there. He obviously had a great deal of trust in this subordinate in his office that apparently was pretty well misplaced. What a mess. I just can't over something that turns out not to be they didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Well, but we'll see. We'll see. So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with the third segment of the Hunt of episode 110 of the Podium and Panel podcast.
Hey, Podium and Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 110 of the Podium and Panel podcast. We don't have a third case, as we mentioned at the top. We just have the COVID and predictions and rule segments. So last week was not quite as quiet as it had been the previous couple of weeks on the BI front. The biggest news might have been the NHL and their communicable disease coverage case. They were seeking $2 billion, and a California court ruled in the partial favor of the insurers last week. And so if the NHL is successful in the contamination communicable disease element of the case, it's not going to be anywhere near the $2 billion that they seek for losses caused by COVID-19. We saw the South Carolina Supreme Court agree
before,
with the other
before
highest
we get
course.
Off that one, before we get off that one, this policy was issued by Factory Mutual. We've heard about them before in prior cases
right.
with this contamination coverage. And we had a prior case that held that it wasn't covered under the contamination coverage that was in the factory mutual policy, but apparently a California court held that it was. But the sublimit for this is very small relative
very small.
To the much larger and usually almost unlimited business interruption coverage that's available. So this is a win, but it's not a very big win. It's right. not a Pyrrhic victory by any sense, but right. it's not a very big win.
Right. And as mentioned, the South Carolina Supreme Court, they issued their ruling last week, and they agree with the other highest courts of states that have found no coverage for business interruption caused by COVID-19. And then the Louisiana Appellate Court, we've talked about the case down there, Conti. An appellate court denied a petition for rehearing, and so we'll see if that gets to the Supreme Court, but probably don't expect a different result if it does.
I'm not so sure. You know, the appellate courts, there have been, you know, there haven't been any appellate court. There's been a couple appellate courts that have gone the way of the policyholder, but that has been, there's not many of those.
That's an exception.
But none of the Supreme Courts have yet.
Nope.
And we'll have to see if the Louisiana Supreme Court goes that direction. So with that, that brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong, Dan. Yep. We are now 164.5, 28.5, and 10. And the case this week that we had was Doe versus USI. And this is the case, this is the Title IX case we discussed the other day in a 27-page opinion, which is kind of long for the Seventh Circuit. And not excessively long, but kind of long, especially on the very short time frame on which they first had this case argued and then issued the opinion. The court held that there was no basis to issue a preliminary injunction because the plaintiff, who was the male student who was alleged to have assaulted the female student, was not likely to succeed. And they very, very clearly articulate it is not some modicum of chance of winning. It is a more likely than not chance of prevailing in order for a preliminary injunction to be issued. And they don't even reach the other questions of, you know, they don't even reach the other questions once they decide that he didn't have a likelihood of success on the merits. They said, you know, it's not our job to relitigate this case or to substitute our view of the procedures. Yes, there are mistakes that were made, the things that weren't done perfectly, but that doesn't mean that he wins. Difficult ongoing road for the plaintiff in this case. Do you want to do our prediction sure to go wrong from this week, Dan? I think we've already kind of said what we think.
I think they both get reversed.
I think they do both get reversed. I think that's the easiest predictions we'll make on this show based on those oral arguments. I would be very surprised if we get either of these wrong.
Right. If it'd be shocking if we get these wrong. So
yeah, it would be. So Dan, tell us about the rule of the week. I think you were there for this one, so let's hear about it.
I was. And last week we talked about Rule 5.4, non-lawyer ownership, and today's rule of the week is a follow-up. Had to do with Resolution 402 that was presented last week at the ABA House of Delegates. And the resolution, as originally stated, was, quote, resolved that the American Bar Association reaffirms Resolution 00A10F as follows. The sharing of legal fees with non-lawyers and the ownership or control of the practice of law by non-lawyers are inconsistent with the core values of the legal profession. The law governing lawyers that prohibits lawyers from sharing legal fees with non-lawyers and from directly or indirectly transferring to non-lawyers ownership or control over entities practicing law should not be revised, end quote. There was an expectation, Pat, that the delegates that were in Chicago last week for the ABA House of Delegates meeting, that there'd be a strenuous debate, as some states, including Arizona and Utah, have experimented in a variety of respects with traditional ownership models and other sandbox types of experiments where regulatory regimes. It happens some in insurance right now, this concept of sandboxes where people can experiment in sandboxes in a relatively safe space. But after much negotiations over the weekend prior to the House of Delegates, there's a lot of, for those that aren't aware of the process, the state and now Metro Bars have a caucus on Sundays. And at those, there's a lot of discussion of upcoming resolutions and people try to find common ground and figure out who's supporting, who's against. And after much debate over the weekend, and to address innovation as a reality, we've talked about innovation and we talked about legal deserts a couple weeks ago. The following language was added to the resolution as a compromise. Quote, further resolved in recognizing the importance to the profession and public of the core values embodied in Model Rule of Professional Conduct 5.4 and in Resolution 00A10F, that nothing in the resolution should be construed as recommending any change to or abrogating in any manner existing ABA policy and Resolution 20M115 adopted by the House at its 2020 mid-year meeting, end quote. And what 20M115 does is it encourages regulatory innovation. John Teese, ISBA President Roy Weiler, and others are to be congratulated for their receiving overwhelming approval of the resolution. When the resolution as amended went up, there was not much, if any, dissent. Maybe one or two people voiced against this reaffirmation. Some have criticized this compromise pad as a mixed message that innovation without the ownership structures would be problematic. But time will tell what innovations and sandboxes look like. And for now, the non-ownership has been reaffirmed by the ABA. And so the debate will continue. One of the other things that is unclear, I know people in Utah and Arizona, is what exactly their models might be tweaked, given this reaffirmation, if their models can continue, or if those states will continue to just experiment despite this kind of admonition.
Very interesting and important issue. We're going to have to keep an eye on this as the states are going to do what they do, and we'll see.
Yep.
How it works out. I have concerns, but individuals, lawyers are regulated in 51 different jurisdictions in Illinois, in the United States. And so that's, we'll have to see how it works out.
Yep.
So with that, we'll take our leave. Thank you everybody for joining us this week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel Podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.